Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about implementing stalling and squashing of instructions. And one thing is we use those tools we learned earlier for pipeline registers to disable writing, which is a signal we called stall, or to put in the default values, which was a signal we called bubble. And we looked at, well, if we're stalling an instruction, if we're pausing an instruction in a particular stage, what needs to happen to the other instructions around it? Therefore, what needs to happen to the pipeline registers? Do we need to keep the same thing in one of them? Do we need one of them to output a no-op? So we look at that, and then we decide how to set our signals, and that's sort of the main thing as far as making the stalling or squashing operation happen, at least with the pipeline register part of it. We also needed to have some logic that actually, decided, are we stalling or not? And we learned that generally the pattern for that is that, well, we'd be passing the I codes of instructions down the pipeline anyway. So we'd retrieve our I code and fetch. We'd send it to the decode stage and so on. And we'd also pass things like register indices down the pipeline, like the register index we're writing to or reading from. And we would query those values from pipeline registers to figure out whether stalling or squashing was appropriate. So for example, with return, we learned that, when we were fetching a return instruction, we're not going to fetch the next instruction usefully until the return instruction gets to the write-back stage. So in the meanwhile, we want to send a bubble down the pipeline. How do we know when to do that? We say, is there a return currently in fetch? Is there currently in decode, rather? Is there a return currently in execute? Is there a return currently in memory? And we can check whether those statements are true by looking at the I code value in the pipeline registers feeding the decode, execute, and memory stages. And we're going to do similar things for other cases where you need to detect stalling and bubbling. Then we started talking about caches. So with caches, we first introduced, well, why do we have caches? And it's because we have this big latency gap. So our registers are really fast. We can read them and write them multiple times per clock cycle. We also have these very fast caches that we can read and write, not quite as fast as registers, but pretty fast. And we have actually multiple levels of these with decreasing speed as we go to levels. You may say, well, why aren't we just using all this really fast cache? And the answer is because we can't make that big enough. We can only get that really low latency off a pretty small amount of storage, and ultimately we want to have the sort of gigabytes of storage we're used to for main memory. So in order to provide good performance from our memory, building using these small caches, we want the caches to usually have the data we're looking for, even though we know that all our data won't fit in them, that we need the main memory for that, or else we wouldn't bother. And in practice, this is basically possible, even though, well, it's not possible in general. If I wrote a program which just accessed a bunch of random memory locations, well, of course, I'm going to get the performance of main memory. But the reason why that doesn't happen, why your typical programs, a typical memory access, looks more like our simulated processor, where it's usually about a cycle-ish, is because we have programs that aren't written to just access random addresses. That's not how you write code. It's not what a useful program does, typically. So we have these two properties, in fact, that sort of organize our memory access that are going to be important for caches to take advantage of. So one of these was what we call temporal locality. And that means that if I'm looking at what memory accesses you're doing, and I see an access to a particular address, I know that with high probability, in a short time later, I'm going to see another access to that address. This won't always be true, but it's just sort of a natural thing which happens. One reason why it happens is we think of like local variables that we're using, like a counter, or the current thing we're displaying on the screen, or the current thing in a file we're editing. We have just values which naturally we access over and over again in our code. And those are going to be things that we want to store in cache. And a simple heuristic that the cache can use to store them is just say, when you access something, I want to store it because you're likely to access it again soon. Sometimes it'll store things that you won't access again soon, but often it will, and you'll get a big speed boost by only paying that latency penalty once at most. Another big property that programs naturally have is what we call spatial locality, that if I'm accessing a value, if I look at other parts of memory that have nearby addresses, I'm likely to access those nearby addresses soon. And this happens naturally because of things like arrays. So if I look at an array, if I access the first element of the array for many, many things I do with that array, I'm probably going to access the second element. Not always true, but often true. And also true for other things, like if I think of like a class, if I access one field of a class, I'm likely to access others, and these are likely to be nearby in memory. So how can a cache take advantage of this? It can just say, I'm going to store big chunks of values from memory, not just like one byte at a time. And this way, when you ask me for one value, I'll get a bunch of values around it, and it's likely, not guaranteed, that you'll use those bunch of values around it, and therefore it will be faster. You won't pay the latency of getting them from memory, you know, after you've paid the latency for the first of those values. So questions about these things we covered last time? Yes? Can I explain the spatial locality question on the quiz? Yes. So I was asked about this morning, so I prepared some slides. On the quiz, we asked which of these had more spatial locality or were they roughly the same? So one was accesses to an array or temporary arrays during a merge sort operation. So if we think of what that looks like, if I'm doing one of the merge operations in the merge sort, I'm going to have two arrays, probably, maybe more than two if I'm doing a different sort of merge sort, but two arrays, and I'm going to be going through them in order, and I'm going to be writing to another array in order. This might be a little weirder if I'm doing the funny in-place merge sort, but we'll just work with the easier version first. And this is good spatial locality. If I saw from the perspective of someone observing this program, and access to here, it's a good guess that things around this will be accessed. And the same thing is true if I see a write to here. It's a good guess there's going to be a write to things nearby. So this has very good spatial locality. So let's compare that to our second option, which was repeated binary searches. So let's think of what a binary search might do. So let's say the element we're finding with our binary search is here. So what we might do that is we'll access about the middle of the array, then we'll access something which is about half the length, quarter length of the array from that. So that would be over here. Then we'll access something in between those two, and then like this. So those would be our accesses. And then we're going to do that again for another pattern of the similar sort, where we access the middle, something halfway away from that, halfway away from that. So in this case, our third access would be here instead. First two would be the same. Then here. We're finding that element. And I do another version of the pattern. My enemy are on the other part of the array. If we overlay all these, we get a pattern where there is sorts of locality, like, well, we have great temporal locality with this element here. So it's probably actually better for the cache. But as far as spatial locality goes, we're just jumping all over the array, and for most of the accesses, like there's not looking at adjacent elements, it's not going to be a good guess that because I saw the access there, I'm going to see an access to a nearby address. Yes, this is somewhat true for the last few accesses, but it's not true to the sort of extent we had with our merge sort, where, you know, it was, you know, for every single access, we're going to access something right nearby. For the binary search, that's true for the last few accesses, and you know, to lesser extents the further back you get. So I think the spatial locality on the binary search is a lot worse compared to the merge sort. Now that doesn't mean the locality overall is worse, because the binary search probably has better temporal locality, but that's not what the question was asking. So questions on this explanation? Okay, so other questions about things we covered last time? Yes?
Like, kind of related to question one from the quiz.
Okay.
Even though we had a feature added, like a, and also like something from last lecture, even if we like, if we stall at certain stages and also add a knock for a certain stage, we should also, if something in memory is not doing anything, we should add a knock to it to ensure that it's doing something. Or else it'll do memory again twice. That makes sense.
So the question is, when we're doing something like stalling, we may need to add a knock to make that work.
Yeah.
Yes. So on question one, for example, we had instruction C, which we wanted to stall. Therefore, we wanted to end it up having it execute again. And if we don't do anything, if we leave pipeline registers in the default state, we'd end up with instruction C in the memory stage, which means we'd end up with, if we did the rest of the stalling operation, we'd end up with two copies of instruction C. And generally, if you see two copies of an instruction in the pipeline, you probably made a mistake. So that would be something we would not want to do. So part of stalling instructions, an instruction in the execute stage, is going to be putting a pipeline bubble in the memory stage, because you have to put something in the memory stage, and you don't want it to be whatever was in the execute stage previously, which what would happen if you did nothing? Yes?
So this is not true if it were in like the fetch stage or decode stage, right?
So the question is, this is not true if it were in the fetch and the decode stage. So in the if it were in the fetch stage, it's not true because there's nothing before it. So no, sorry, it is true in the fetch stage, yes. So if we were stalling an instruction in the fetch stage, we'd have to put a pipeline bubble in the decode stage. So we saw this, for example, with how we implemented stalling for return. Right, we were doing junk in the fetch stage, so we put a pipeline bubble in the decode stage to make that work. So it's generally going to be true that if there's a following stage, if the stage you're stalling is not write back, you're going to have to insert a pipeline bubble to implement the stalling instruction operation. And I guess something that may make this easier to think about is, yes, the signal is called stall in our textbook in HCLRS, but maybe it would be better to think of it as just write disable. So you're going to do the write disable operation, but that's not all of implementing stalling and instruction, because you have to worry about the other pipeline registers around it. So the other thing which seems to confuse people a lot on stalling an instruction is that in this question, we were stalling instruction C. But that meant that we had to think about the instructions that were behind it in the pipeline, the ones which were fetched later. So instruction D in decode, we have to think about what needs to happen to that instruction. And we have some options. So one option that, well, the default would be that it advances to execute. We can't do that because C needs to be in execute, or else we're not stalling instruction C. So one option would be that we could get rid of the instruction. But that's something we weren't told to do. We weren't told to squash instruction D, and by default, we went to execute instructions. So that's not an option. So we're left with our third option, which is that we have to leave it in the decode stage. So even though I would say we're only stalling instruction C, a consequence of that is that we have to pause instruction D and E behind it in order to not lose them. Other questions? Okay, so I guess also came up in the other lecture, and I probably should just go over it briefly here, is people were also confused about questions 4 and 5 on temporal locality. So this was about temporal locality. So temporal locality, if I access something, I'll access it again soon. So one was about iterating through a large array on the stack. And this generally, if we're only iterating once, accesses to that large array have very bad temporal locality. Because if we think of any particular array element, once we see an access to it, we're not going to see another. So there's great spatial locality. It's actually pretty good for the cache. And if we were accessing it multiple times, it might be better for the cache. And then access to the machine code of a small frequently used function. We tell you it's frequently used. So if we see an access to a piece of machine code, we're going to see an access again. Now, some people got a little tripped up here because they really wanted to compare the machine code for A to the machine code for B. And I think they would probably be similar because we have a loop in A that maybe is accessed more frequently than our frequently used function. And I think if we were comparing the machine code, it would be fair to say that the temporal locality is about the same or maybe better for A. And I meant to specify only the data accesses for A, but I think even if you're comparing both of them, you have to consider the machine code and the data accesses for A. If you want to compare that, the temporal locality for A should be worse overall because the temporal locality for those array accesses is so bad. Right, that's probably like most of the memory accesses, or maybe not most, but a lot of the memory accesses we're doing should be those array accesses. And we're kind of comparing a mix of very good and very bad temporal locality with good temporal locality. It should probably be the mix is worse overall. But I agree, I should have specified only the data accesses for A explicitly. So then on question 5 was asking about a repeated access to hash table key versus a repeated linear search. So for a repeated access to a particular hash table key, we'd be just pinpointing a particular element in the array, or if we had to follow a hash table chain, a small set of elements in the array, versus a linear search, where we'd be accessing, on average, about half of the array over and over again. So if you think of how many things we're accessing, for the second example, it's a lot more. And accessing more things should be a red flag to you that probably the temporal locality is worse. Because just because we have to access more things, it's going to be more time between when we access something twice. So even though if we like do 100 accesses to the hash table by key, by a particular key, or 100 linear searches for a particular key, we're going to, you know, do the same number of access, same number of, you know, key reads. As far as the time between each access, it's going to be much lower for our hash table lookup, and therefore the temporal locality should be better. Okay, so questions on our temporal locality examples? Okay, so let's get to our main topic, which is building caches. So we mentioned this locality, and we're going to take advantage of it by storing blocks of data which are more than 1 byte. For this example, I'm only going to use 2 bytes, so it fits on my slide. But in a real cache, we'd probably use bigger. And I'm going to have 8 bytes here, and I want to make a cache with this. And I'm going to make a very simple cache, and I'm going to design things here using a design called a direct map cache, which is going to be very efficient to do lookups. So the first thing is I have 8 bytes to store data in. I'm going to divide that into 4 blocks of 2 bytes. So I've just decided that's how much data I'm storing, so 8 bytes worth of data. And right now, it's all zeros. And the CPU is going to ask the cache, hey, I have an address I'd like to read data from. And in this case, the CPU is asking to read this BB here. And ideally, we'd like to get that value without going to memory, because going to memory is slow. So we'd like to find out where in these 4 blocks of data that is. And right now, the answer should be it isn't there, because we haven't stored anything in this cache yet. But if I only look at the cache right now, that information is not available to me. So my solution is I'm going to have a little extra information for bookkeeping. So the first piece of information we're going to need, well, is going to be, you know, indicating whether or not it's there. But before that, I have to figure out, well, which of these blocks would I look in anyways? So we're going to start with that. And I'm going to try to keep things simple and say I'm only going to look in one place for each part of memory. So I'm going to say that this first 2 bytes of memory, if we're storing it in our cache, we're going to store it here. This next 2 bytes of memory, if we're storing it in our cache, we're going to store it in the next block. And I'm going to keep doing that. And when I get to the 5th byte block, I'm going to store it back in the first block of memory, the first block of the cache, because we've run out. We're just going to go back to the beginning. So this will mean that our first block of the cache goes to the first block of memory, the 5th block of memory, the 9th block of memory, and so on. And the way this works out, I can figure out what block of the cache I go to, what row I'm going to, by looking at 2 bits of the address. And that's not a coincidence. That's because I made some very careful choices in designing this cache. I made sure the number of bytes I was storing in each block was a power of 2. And that's why the ranges of these addresses are all from something 0 to something 1, because it's 2 to the 1 is the size of my blocks, 2 bytes. And I made sure the number of rows I have, which we'll call sets, as we'll learn later, is a power of 2. It's 2 to the 2, or 4. And since it's 2 to the 2, there are 2 bits of the address that tell me which set it corresponds to. And this is really useful because in our cache, we want to very quickly figure out which of these blocks to go to find our data if it's there. And we can just look at certain bits. We don't have to do a modulus operation, which would be hideously slow compared to the sort of performance we want. So we have this mapping where we just look at those bits. And in this case, we're going to want to read from our 2nd block, because that's where we would store this value. Now, if we look there, though, it's not there. So we're going to need, as I alluded to earlier, we're going to need some way of remembering that it's not there. So we're going to add an extra bit of actually stored metadata we'll call the valid bit. So for each block, we're going to store a 0 if we haven't put anything there yet, and a 1 otherwise. So in this case, what we're going to do is we're going to look at that 2nd row. We're going to check the valid bit first, and it's 0. So that means that this thing that the CPU is asking for, we don't got it. So what are we going to do? We're going to go to the main memory and get it. And we're going to hand off the 2nd byte of it to the CPU. Why the 2nd byte? Because that's the particular part it's asking for. It has this 1 here, which is the last part of these 2 bytes. And we're going to, because of temporal locality, we're going to say, we need to store this in our cache. So we're going to drop that in there. So questions so far? Yes?
So like, in the question 5 on the quiz, like for the example here.
Yeah.
Like, for an array, if you're iterating through it, like you pull an entire like set of bytes, right? And then you access those bytes. If you look at a hash table, you would be pulling like a byte in one location of the hash table, then never access again because you have to bounce to the next like, location in the hash table.
So the question is, in the context of the question on the quiz, we'd be pulling, so you're saying, wouldn't the hash table have very poor temporal locality because we'd access something and never access it again? So the question on the quiz was repeatedly accessing a particular key.
Oh, okay.
So we would be accessing something again, but yes, the things we would be accessing again would be scattered randomly in the array, but that doesn't matter because we'll just fill in 1 block and that's fine. A question?
So this so far hasn't done anything optimization-wise because we've still just done a memory access.
So far we've just done a memory access. So the question is now that we fetched it, let's say the processor does this operation again, like we predict with temporal locality. So what we're going to do is we're going to go to the 2nd row of the cache. We're going to say it's valid. That's great. So we have this potential value here. Now we still have a problem, which is that this value could have come from here instead. And we haven't done the bookkeeping to distinguish between that. So we need to do a little extra bookkeeping before we can actually give the processor back the value. And we'll have to do this when we store the value. And we're going to store some extra information known as the tag. And what's the tag going to be? It's going to be the part of the address we didn't use to actually look up the location in the cache. So far, we used the last bit of this address here. This determines where in a block. And this, as we'll learn, we're going to call the offset. So we use that to determine whether to return AA or BB to the processor. And we used the next two bits to determine which row, which, as we'll learn, is called the index, which is also what's labeled in this diagram. So we've used that. But the remaining bits we haven't used, we're going to store those as the tag. And that's going to distinguish between whether we stored the bytes from addresses, in this case, 2 through 3, or addresses 2 plus 8, 10 through 11 here. Or something further down in memory. So when the processor asked for the byte at 01011 again, we're going to look in row with index 1, because we'll look at those two bits. We're going to see that it's valid, so we're going to compare the tag. We're going to say, does 01 match the 01 here? The answer is yes. So yes, we have your data. Then we're going to look at the offset to determine which part of what I have stored do you want? And we're going to say, oh, it's 1. You want the BB, not the AA. And that's when we give it back to the processor. And that's how next time we're going to save on doing a memory access. Questions? Yes, back there.
What does valid mean?
So what does valid mean? Valid means we have something stored there. So in the case of indexes 0, 2, and 3, we haven't put anything in the cache yet. And we need to distinguish that between, for example, if the processor asks for address 0, we need to know, or address 1, we need to know that this here is not the contents of address 1, even though otherwise it would look like that.
So how do you know which bits are tag or index or valid?
Question is, how do I know which bits are like tag or index or valid? OK, so first of all, let's distinguish between bits that are from our address and bits which are other metadata. So the valid bit is something which we just set in our cache only, which tells us, have we retrieved a value from an address like this yet? The tag and index and offset bits are parts of our address. We store the tag part because it's not determined by where in the cache we're looking. If I see something in this part of the cache, I don't need to look at anything to know that it must have come from something with index 0, because we only put things with index 0 there. But I do need to look at something to know what the upper bits of the address are, so that's why I'm storing it. But to know whether I actually stored a tag there, I need to look at the valid bit, because otherwise there had to be some initial value for the tag, and all of them look like real addresses. So I have to have an extra bit to tell the difference. Does that answer your question?
Yes, really. Yeah, it does.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, what are we reading when we read this address here? So this, according to our memory diagram, the contents of the bytes 01010 to 01011 are AA and BB, presumably in hexadecimal. So the second of those must be the one being asked for, 01011. So we should return BB as the result to the processor, assuming it's asking for just one byte. Yes? Sorry, we store. So the question is, what are we storing from the address in the cache? So the only thing we're storing is the tag. So the valid bit is 1 because that just means true. It's not part of the address. So we would store the exact same thing in the cache if the processor had instead asked for the first byte of the block. The only difference would be that we return a different part of the block to the processor. But we'd store the exact same thing. We'd do the exact same lookup. What? Would the tag be different in the second one? No, because the tag, remember, was the bits other than those parts we used to look up, find the value. So the tag is the first 2 bits. It would be exactly the same. So everything about the lookup would be the same, except for the part where we determine which part of the block to give back to the processor. Other questions? Okay. So now we know how caches, sort of the idea. Let's have sort of a diagram of how these notionally work. So we'll have a cache here. And we're going to take in an address. I've written the address in binary. And as I mentioned, we're going to divide the address into 3 pieces. We're going to have this middle piece called the index. And the index will determine which row of the cache to go to. So we'll have our cache, we'll have a bunch of rows. We'll have some machinery where we specify a row number, and it's going to output to some hardware the values we have stored in that row, which are going to include the actual data we have stored in that row, and the metadata, the tag, and the valid bits. And in this example, we have 8 rows. So our index is 3 bits, because we need 3 bits to get two to the three values distinguished, which is 1 of our 2 to the 3 equals 8 rows. So once we retrieve the values from that row, we're going to have to do 2 things with them. We're going to have to compare the tag, so those upper bits of the address, and we're going to have to check the valid bit. And I've shown you an example where the hardware might be doing those in parallel. And if the tag matches and the valid bit is set, we have what is known as a hit. The value is actually in our cache. If it's not a hit, we're going to have to do the extra work of retrieving a value and filling it into the cache, and also returning it back to the processor, which is going to be waiting for it. Now, we have another part of this, which is that I'm going to get 4 bytes of data, but the processor is asking for a particular part of that. So I'm going to need to take my 4 bytes of data and extract one of those 4 bytes that the processor wants. I'm going to use the offset bits, the lower bits of the address, to do that. And in this case, since we're storing 4 bytes of data, I have 2 offset bits, because that tells me whether it's byte 0, 1, 2, or 3 of the block. Questions? Separation. Yes?
So if you like look at like an index and it's like a miss, I guess you could say, you just like replace that index with like the...
So the question is, on a miss, where are we going to store the values? Is it going to go in that row? Yes. So if we have a miss, we're going to fill in the row that the miss came from with the block from memory that contains the address the processor was asking for. And we're going to fill that in, even if it involves replacing something that the processor might want to. Okay, other questions? Yes? The question is, the offset's at the end, the tag's in the middle. Sorry, the index is in the middle and the tag's at the beginning. Yes, and that's always the order we'll use. So the offset's always at the end because it's where in the block, and the blocks are always actually adjacent in memory, so it has to be at the end. The index being just before it is maybe a little less obvious, because we could make a cache where that's not true. But this turns out to be basically the best design, and one reason we can think of this is spatial locality, that if I have an array, I would like to be able to store like a segment of that array in the cache. And if we... it's probably easier to illustrate here. So that means, for example, I'd like my cache to be able to store, if this was the beginning of my array, those 2 blocks at the same time. And if I chose to make my index bits, you know, be further up in the number, those two would have the same index. And that would be very bad. So that's why we choose the index bits to be right next to the offset bits. Okay. That answer your question? So the question is, why is 100 going where it goes? And it's just that I'm numbering the rows. So the first row is 000, 001, 010, 011, 100. I'm just counting. And it's just a number, in this case, four, row four, starting at zero. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so as a terminology thing, what we have as a row of our cache, I'm going to use the term set. And as a preview, in the future, we'll have multiple blocks per set, but right now we only have one. And I'm going to call the row a set to distinguish from the data for a block and all the data in the row, including our valid entanglement. Yes? So the question is, the tag defines the length of cache we are trying to address? I would not say that. The tag says if we have multiple things in memory which could go to that place, the tag tells us which one is there. So in this example, the two blocks of memory highlighted in blue are both things we can store in the second row of this cache. And the tag is going to tell us which one did we actually store. That's how we're going to record that information. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so now that we know addresses being split up into a tag, index, and offset, I have three different caches here. And all of them are storing a value at address 001111, and which happens to be the byte 0xFF. It's all highlighted in red. And my question here is, how do we split up this address into a tag, index, and offset for these three different caches? So something you should be able to figure out. And the reasoning you should go on is, how many bits do we need for each of these? Based on how big our blocks are, how many rows we have, other hints there may be on the slide because I've given you rather complete information. So who can get me started on this? Get me any part of any answer. Yeah.
I can say that like all three caches just need 7 bits and you can access like any address that's 7 bits, you can access any of the information either.
So why 7 bits? So first of all, note that the valid bit is never part of the address. The valid bit is just, have we stored anything here, no matter what the addresses were? So, and that's why it's not part of the table. Yes?
For the first one, it's the tag. The tag is 01, the off index is 11.
So for the first one, the tag is, you said 001, and the index is 11. Offset is 1. So how did you figure that out? How did you know the tag is 3 bits? So you just said, oh, you hopefully wrote the right number of zeros there. Okay? And how about the rest of it? So for the index, there are 4 sets, 4 rows. That's 2 to the 4, sorry, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, yep, 2 to the 2, doing arithmetic. 2 to the 2, so we need 2 bits to determine that. We could also see that by the fact that to label the indices, we had 0, 0 through 1, 1. So there are 2 bits for the index. That's how you tell it how long that is. And how about the offsets? How did you figure out? There's 2 values. So we have 2 things in the block. To distinguish between those 2, we need 1 bit, because it's 2 to the 1. And how I would figure this out without the benefit of assuming the diagram is correct would be that I'd start with the offset probably. I'd say, oh, we have 2 to the 1 bytes per block, therefore I need 1 offset bit. And then I'd say, oh, how many sets do we have? We have 2 to the 2, so I need 2 index bits. So I take the last bit as my offset bit, the next 2 bits as my index bits, and everything left over is the tag. I'd always figure out the tag last because the tag is just what's left over. Okay, so questions on that? Okay, so volunteers for answers for any of the other rows. Yeah. Okay. Index is 1. Offset is 1, 1. So, okay, that seems right to me. So how did you figure out the offset?
There are 4 values, so it's
4 values in the block. We have down here, we have, so they're going to be 0, 1, 2, 3. So that's 2 to the 2 to store which part of that we're getting. And we take the last 2 bits of the address. For the index, we have 2 rows, so 1 index bit. And then we'll get to our middle one here. So this, the one remaining, we have 2 byte blocks, so that's going to be 1 offset bit. That's going to be our last bit here. We have 8 sets, so 8 is 2 to the 3, so we have 3 index bits, which are going to be our next 3 bits from our address, and our tag is going to be 00. So questions on how I figured this all out? So the question is that if I have 2 to the x is my block size, then x is the number of offset bits, yes. And if I have 2 to the x is the number of sets, the number of rows I have, x is the number of index bits, yes. So you may see these formulas in the textbook, and you're welcome to use these formulas. The reason I didn't start you with that is a lot of people have had this habit of just plugging and chugging with these formulas and then not knowing how the caches really work. And I want you to be able to reason the other way, so you don't need to just think about, I must memorize these formulas to solve these problems, rather than being able to derive them and therefore check your answers better. Okay, so far we've worked with kind of toy caches. So let's do some more realistic sizes. So let's say I have a cache with 64 byte blocks and 128 sets. So if it's direct mapped, it would store 8 kilobytes. This is closer to the size that you might have for a L1 cache on a real processor. First question is, if the addresses are 32 bits, how many tag, index, and offset bits do we have? So I'll give you time to do that work. Okay, who would like some more time? One person. So I've drawn our diagram of what this cache kind of looks like. So we have sort of our same set of rows. We have 128 of them. And the data part is 64 bytes wide. And we also have, in addition to the data, we're storing a valid bit and a tag bit, and as we might learn later, maybe some other bookkeeping information. Okay, so let's start with offset bits. Who thinks we have one offset bit? Two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, more than eight. Okay, so we have pretty good consensus around six, which is what I agree with. Why six? Because we have 2 to the 6 byte blocks. So how about index bits? Thinks we have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 or more. Okay, so we have good consensus on 7 index bits, and I agree. So we have 2 to the 7 rows. So tag bits are what's left over. So we're going to have 32 minus 7 times 6 for our tag bits. So that's 32 minus 7 plus 6, rather. So that's going to be 19 tag bits. Okay, so let's get to our second question. So which bytes are going to be stored in the same block as the byte from 1037? So note that there are some leading zeros on this address I haven't written out, so don't try to start counting tag bits from the beginning, because that's given you the last 16 bits and the other ones are zeros, I just didn't write the zeros. And it's asking, basically, so if we read the block containing this, it's going to read a bunch of stuff around it. Which of those other bytes are in that stuff around it? Yes, back there? We'll answer later. Thank you. And as a hint, like, I figured out tag index and offset bits because I strongly recommend using that to answer this question. If you aren't using the index and offset, or at least if you aren't using one of those, something is, you're likely not to get the right answer. And, oh, I should. And so something which will be handy now and in the near future is I can convert hexadecimal to binary by going a hexadecimal nibble at a time. So the last 8 bits of this number are 0011, the 3, and 0111, the 7. And I could keep going to get the next few bits. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is one of the answers? B, C, D. Okay, so we have a little bit of disagreement about A. So the way I would figure this out is that if things are in the same block, then they have to have the same index, because we only store things in that row if the index matches, and they have to have the same tag, because the tag tells us where we got the block from. So the tag and index need to be the same, so the only thing which would be different is the offset bits. And we know we have 6 offset bits, and there are least significant bits, so we know that these here in our original address are offset bits. So that block is all the things with the addresses that look like that, except we replace the offset bits with any possible set of bits. So it ranges from all zeros to all ones. Those are all the addresses in the block. So, if we think of the all zeros for these addresses, we're going to have 00000, which would be, if we put this back into hexadecimal, 1000. So that's the beginning of the block. Now, how about the end of the block? So if we think of the end of the block, we're going to replace the offset bits with all ones. So that's going to be 1, 0, same beginning part. And then we have a 3 and an F, if I convert back to hex. So that's the range of addresses that are in the same block. And A, B, and C all overlap with that. Another way I could have figured this out is that I could have taken each of these addresses and checked their index and tag bits, which essentially would be removing the last 6 bits of each of them and comparing those values. And if they're the same, we're in the same row, and the tag would match. They're from the same block. That would give me the same answer. So questions on how I figured this out? Yes?
How do you get 1,000 again?
How do I get 1,000? So I just said my offset bits are these 6 bits here. So the beginning of the block, I replace them all with zeros. If I replace them with zeros, then this 3,7 is going to turn into 0,0.
Oh.
And the rest of the numbers stay the same. I could have like written out the whole binary number, but that seems like it would take up a lot of time and space. And 3F is what I get when I put 1s in all those offset bits. Yes. Other questions? Okay. So now that we Now how addresses are split up, let's go through an example of how these caches might work with multiple accesses. So here I have a cache. I have 2-byte blocks and 4 sets. So if I want to figure out how that cache works with memory accesses, first thing I want to figure out is how many tag, index, and offset bits there are. And I can say, okay, I have 2-byte blocks. Therefore, my block size is 2 to the number of offset bits. So that number is 2 to the 1. So I have 1 offset bit, and I have 4 sets. That's 2 to the 2 sets, so I have 2 index bits. And then I can just figure out from all my addresses, I have an offset, that's my last bit, that 1 bit. I have 2 bits of index, and everything else left over is our tag. So now that I have that, I can figure out what these accesses do. And I'm assuming I'm starting with an all invalid cache. So I'm going to look at my first access here, and I'm going to say, okay, so we're accessing address 0,0, which has an index of 0. So I'm going to look at row with index 0. I'm going to first check the valid bit. It's 0. Therefore, nothing's stored there. It must be a miss. But a consequence of that miss is we're going to have to bring in the data at that address, whatever it is. We don't have that written down, so I've just written memory's contents of that address, whatever it was. And we're going to have to store it there. And when we store it there, we're going to have to remember where it came from. We have to know that it came from address 0,0 and not address 8,0. So to do that, I'm going to store my tag bits, which in this case are 5,0 bits. Then I access address 0,1. So for this, I'm going to say, okay, I have index 0, so I'm going to look at index 0. I'm going to check, is it valid? Yes. So then I'm going to compare the tags. And I see the tag in my address is all zeros. The tag I'm accessing is all zeros, so it's going to be a hit. And this makes sense if we think of spatial locality. Our cache took advantage of spatial locality, so accessing something nearby was actually faster, hopefully. So then I have my next access. I'm going to access address 6,3. I look at the index. It's 0,1. So I'm going to look in the second row, this cache. It's not valid. So it's going to be a miss. And I'm going to bring in that data. So in this case, our tag from the address is 0,1,1,0,0. So that's what gets stored in my tag, along with the contents of memory containing that block, which starts with offset 0. So that's why it starts at 6,2, not 6,3, because that's what happens with offset 0 of that block. Yes.
So, how it works? The spatial locality works because if you have if it's in your byte block, then it's not by default to pull out. If you access 00, memory address 00, not just build an export slot by default.
So the question is, in this case, I'm accessing 00 and 01, and you'd like the cache to fill in 02? Yes, so that is a reasonable thing to want. This cache design does not do that. That is something that real processor caches do, but it's not something we are implementing yet. Now, if we made our blocks bigger, we get closer to what you want, without making our cache more complicated. But in order to really do that, we need to have some separate logic that looks at what we've accessed recently explicitly, which processors do that. This is called prefetching, but that's not something we're doing yet. Okay, other questions? Okay. So we access 6.3, you filled in the cache. Next we have an access to address 6.1. We're gonna look at our index bits. It's 00. We check if it's valid. It is, but we're not done yet. Just because there's something there doesn't mean it came from the right address. And in this case, in fact, it didn't. It came from address 00 through 01. We're going to compare the tag. We're going to find out they don't match. So that's going to be a miss, but we're assuming temporal locality. We're saying, I just accessed 6.1. I'm probably going to access it again soon. And in fact, I think because of temporal locality, I'm more likely to access it again soon than address 00001. That's not true in this case, but that's the assumption we make when we design caches. So I'm going to replace that value with addresses 6.0 and 6.1. Then I access 6.2. So that's going to be a hit. I'm going to look up in set 1. I'm going to see if it's valid. It is. I'm going to see if the tag matches. It will. So that's going to be a hit, and I'm going to return the data to the processor. Then I access 00. We've accessed it earlier, but when I look in my cache, I'm going to say index 0. Is it valid? Yes. Does the tag match? No, it doesn't, because we replaced it with something else. So that's going to be a miss, and we're going to put in something else, which is 00 and 01. The thing we accessed earlier, we're going to have to retrieve again from memory. And then finally, I have an address 6.4, so I look at my index, it's 10, that's invalid, so that's going to be another miss, and we're going to put in byte 6.4 and 6.5. So questions about any part of this access pattern here? So I guess something we'll deal with later. But since we've done that, let's do an alternate version here. So here, I've changed the cache to have 4-byte blocks. So I've made our spatial locality better because we now store bigger blocks. And that also means how this access pattern is going to be handled is different. So one thing we want to figure out first before we do this again is we want to divide this up into sort of our tag, index, and offset. We want to see how these addresses divide up. So we're going to say, okay, we have 4-byte blocks. So we have 4 equals 2 to the what? And that's going to be 2 to the 2. So we're going to have 2 offset bits. So for our example address here, our offset bits are 0, 1. And we have, again, 4 sets. So we're going to have 2 to the 2 bits, so we have 2 index bits, so our index bits are 0, 0 here, and everything else is the tag, which happens to be 4 bits. And once we know that, we can overlay that like so. So now that we have that, so figure out which of these accesses are going to be hits. And we're starting again, assume everything starts invalid. I don't have it written down, so I can write on this slide. Thank you. Who would like some more time? Okay, so first access, who thinks it's a hit? Miss. Okay, so we have consensus that that's a miss, which it should be because nothing's in our cache yet. So that's going to put in our address 0, which is going to be memory at 00 through 03. Second access, who thinks it's going to be a hit? Okay, I would agree. So that's going to be a hit. Third access, who thinks it's going to be a hit? A miss. And that's going to be a miss. And it's going to replace our first access. So we're going to have, instead of tag 000, we're going to have 011 and memory at 60 to 63 instead. How about our access to 61? Who thinks it's going to be a hit? Okay, I would agree. 62, I think it's going to be a hit. Okay, we have a pretty good consensus there. Access to 00 again. Is that going to, who thinks that's going to be a hit? A miss. We have consensus that that's a miss. Access to 64. Who thinks that's going to be a hit? A miss. So I think a miss is better. And because it goes to set 01, which doesn't have anything in it, so it has to be a miss. Okay, so questions about this exercise here? Yes, back there. So the question is, how do we know when a block is replaced versus when a block is written into another row? So in our direct map caches, what we're working with so far, we always have to use the row that the index says. So whatever's in there, if it's there's nothing there, we just put it there. If whatever's in there gets replaced, if there's something there, we don't have a choice. And you know, that's kind of unfortunate, and this was kind of unfortunate in these access patterns. We had these misses caused by what we call conflicts, namely that we had two things which happened to have the same set index, and this meant that it seemed like we were kind of storing data inefficiently in our cache because we had, in many of these cases, a whole block free, like not even used for anything yet. So couldn't we do better than that? So we're going to have a cache design where we can do better. And we're going to modify our direct map cache and make it a bit more complicated in order to give ourselves better options to avoid replacing things that we might need again. And that's going to be by making our rows wider. So rather than storing one block per row, we'll store two or more. I'm only showing two right now, just so the slide isn't too cluttered, but it could be more than two. And so each set will have multiple blocks in it. So we'll call the rows, as we've been calling them, sets. And you see why I'm using the name set. And we'll call the columns ways. And consequently, we're going to name this a two-way set associative cache. So the sets are associative. They have multiple parts, association of things. And we have two ways in this case. We could have more than two ways, but we'll start with just two ways. And yes.
So are you saying it's associative because there's a connection between the index and part of the memory?
Question, is I saying it's associated because of the connection between index and part of the memory? I'm not sure what the origin of the term is. But set associative is the term that everyone uses as jargon, regardless of what the original origin is and whether it makes sense anymore. But presumably it's an associative array play, I would guess, but I'm not sure. Okay, and as far as tag, index, and offset stuff, this works the same as we've seen before, that if we want to figure out how many index bits, we say, oh, we have this many sets, therefore, you know, we have two sets, so that's 2 to the 1, we have one index bit. We want to figure out how many block offset bits, we have 2 byte blocks, 2 to the 1 bytes per block, so we have 1 block offset bit. And we can apply the same sort of principles we've seen before. So I'm going to do the same access pattern we've done. This time, I have 1 offset bit and 1 exit bit. So I'm going to say address 0, that's a miss. And we're going to bring in the block containing address 0, which, like before, is the byte at 0 and 1. We're going to store a 6-bit tag of all zeros. and we're going to just choose an arbitrary way that is free. In this case, either of them would do. I'm just arbitrarily use the first one. Then I access 1. That's going to be a hit. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go to the set with index 0, and I'm going to look at both of the ways. And I'm going to find that one of them is valid. So I'm going to check the valid one. The invalid one can't have the data I'm looking for. I'm going to compare the tag. I'm going to find it matches. So I have a hit. Then I'm going to move on to our access to 6.3. This goes to set index 1. When I look initially, I'm going to find out, oh, both of the ways are invalid. It's not stored there. It's going to be a miss. And I'm going to load it in. Then we access 6.1. I'm going to go to set index 0. I'm going to check both ways. So the first way, it's valid. So I'm going to check further. I'm going to compare this tag of all zeros to my address, and it doesn't match. So it's not there. So I'm going to also check the second way. It's invalid, so it can't be there. So we have a miss. We didn't find it. We looked in both ways. And I'm going to store it. And when I store it, I'm not going to be silly. And I'm going to say, OK, I have something where I'm not storing any data that's useful. So I'm going to put it in the second way, where there's no useful data yet, and fill that up. And in this case, for the first time, we've gotten an option other than just replacing something that happened to be in the same set. So now when we access 6.2, so 6.2, I'm going to go to index 1. I'm going to check both ways. The first way is valid, and the tag matches, so that's going to be a hit. Now I access 0.0, and this is what caused us problems before. Before, this was a miss because we always accessed 6.1, which always got rid of 0.0. But that's no longer the case now. I look at index 0, and I check both of these. So I look at the first way and say, is it valid? Yes. Does the tag match? Yes. So that's going to be a hit. I'd also check the second way, but that's not going to match because the tag won't match. I'm going to say it's not there. So I'm going to say it's a hit, and I'm going to return the data from the first way, not the second one. Okay. Questions so far? So one thing that we haven't covered is what to do in our next case. So in this case, I'm accessing index 0. So I check here. This is valid, so I do the tags match. All zeros doesn't match that. Check, do these tags matches? Well, this tag ends with a 0, and this one ends with a 1, so it doesn't match. So this is a miss. Now, there's a question here. I have two places I can put this miss. Which one do I choose? And that's something we'll talk about next time.